I'm Carl Quintanilla. You're listening to CNBC's Tech Check. Our show is live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Listen in. Good Friday morning. Welcome to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla with John Fort and Julia Boorstin. Today, Bitcoin and Ethereum tumble. China kicks crypto, calls all related activities illegal. It's hitting Coinbase and Robinhood as well. Plus, iPhone 13 models hit the shelves today, but you may have to wait a while to get your hands on one. We'll get a deeper dive on Apple demand. And then one software name soaring, why an analyst says it's a must own for growth investors, John.
Yeah, and we will start with stocks lower today, a sell-off to start the week, a rally followed. Mike Santoli is putting this week's volatility into perspective for us. Mike?
Yeah, John, pretty much a round trip for the S&P 500 from last Friday's close is where we're trading right now. But there has been a lot of movement under the surface. In fact, the breakout higher in Treasury yields might be one of the more significant ones and kind of says a lot about style rotation, things like that. Take a look at the year-to-date chart here of the NASDAQ 100 ETF along with the S&P 500 value. So a lot of contrast here. Right here when the NASDAQ 100 was really suffering into that early March, that's when 10-year yields were racing above 1.7. That was the huge sell-off in Treasuries, and you saw value did just fine through there. Similarly, yet another one of these runs above 1.7 into May, and that's when they peaked and bottomed, and that was the big run in big cap growth from that point on. Now, it's been a little more muddled since then. Of course, you can see it's not a perfect either-or type market. They're both higher year-to-date, even though yields have come up a fair bit. But it is worth questioning right now as we see this breakout in 10-year Treasury yields. If that lasts above 1.4 as we get higher, maybe it crosses 1.5, is that the occasion for another one of these periods where large-cap tech stocks take a little bit of a back seat to the more cyclical sectors, guys?
Mike, are investors reacting at all to what's coming or not coming out of Washington around debt ceiling, around taxes? I mean, it seems like we're kind of, like you said, back where we were a week ago. So, I mean, apparently nothing that has actually happened is something to react to. But is there something down the pike that we should be concerned about?
At this point, John, I don't think the debt ceiling deadline is really biting much at all. Yes, it's kind of one of the several things that's hovering over investor psychology, but we've been through it enough times. You can squint and look at some effects in the, you know, short-term bond market and things like that. People maybe think there's going to be a delay in some Treasury bill repayments, something like that. Otherwise, not really. I do think there's a general, you know, hey, maybe the easy part's over. Maybe we got that huge fiscal push last time. Doubts we're going to get another one. And obviously a lot of wrangling over the debt ceiling before we actually get one passed, presumably at this point.
Mike, thanks. Appreciate that very much. So much to keep our eyes on, and it's much easier with Mike's help. Let's turn to crypto. Crypto and crypto-exposed stocks are falling after the People's Bank of China said all crypto-related activities are, quote, illegal. Bitcoin and Ethereum on pace for their worst week since May when China cracked down on mining, leading to the currencies seeing declines of 28 and 41% respectively. Names like Coinbase and Robinhood also in focus, generating a lot of revenue from crypto trades. Although Needham's got a pretty good note this morning, John, looking at Coinbase platform volumes. And they say if volumes continue at the current pace for the remainder of the month, September will be the second best month for Coinbase ever.
Yeah, I don't get it. Julia, do you get it? I mean, China hates crypto. That's news to some people. Like, the crypto's moving on that.
Well, China has said a number of times in a number of different ways it hates crypto. And I have to say, I just this morning interviewed Diamond Hands. Diamond Hands is an entrepreneur who has created various different platforms in the blockchain space. And he said, you know, I've heard this one before. The question is how much this time is different. You know, once China announced that it was going to crack down on the mining of crypto, Carl, then the question is this dramatically different from that? But Diamond Hands told me that he's keeping an eye on it, but not that concerned.
Interesting. And then we've been talking about watching the futures of Bitcoin in particular, John, have gone into what's known as backwardation. J.P. Morgan earlier in the week suggesting that maybe that's showing an eroding interest by institutions in Bitcoin specifically. And even that Needham note that I mentioned says a lot of the activity that's coming from now is from L1 tokens like Solana and others.
Yeah, it makes me wonder when you get, an asset that's moving based on something that should be obvious, like negative news, then can you believe the upward movement when there's positive news either? Or is this a market where stuff just wants to move for no particular reason? And, you know, do you have to be really careful about what your thesis is on what the underlying value is on everything? Because the signal that you're getting in this market, Carl, just might not be telling you much for the medium or longer term.
Yeah, very true. Difficult market to navigate. Meantime, Lina Khan laying out her vision to crack down on big tech. In a memo to the FTC staffers and commissioners, the chair laid out her policy priorities, including addressing rampant consolidation, dominant intermediaries, extractive business models, and assessing how contracts can set up unfair methods of competitions or deceptive practices. Khan's skepticism of the big tech firms is echoed by a recent poll conducted for the Future of Tech Commission, with 80% of voters agreeing that, quote, the federal government needs to do everything it can to curb the influence of big tech companies that have grown too powerful and now use our data to reach too far into our lives. However, on the flip side, a majority of voters also feel that breaking up the tech giants, quote, threatens our country's biggest drivers of innovation and growth. And you can imagine some of the leaders, Julia, of those tech companies arguing that very point, that you need your giants to do well.
Carl, this is such a complex issue. The part of this that was most interesting to me was the way Lina Khan defined what her job is. And that's about not just protecting consumers, but she wanted to sort of expand that idea of preventing harm to also be about employees and small businesses as well. So pretty broad definition there. And then there's also the question of, like, she wants to get to the source of problems rather than putting a Band-Aid as a solution. And I think, John, this is going to be really complicated as we move forward because of that push-pull issue. The fact that people want to be protected, they don't want their data to be exploited. At the same time, they want the convenience of all of these apps that are on our phones that give us whatever we want whenever we want it.
Yeah, I still don't think that this is being framed correctly as I track these issues. It seems to me that there's a question of rules of the road in the digital economy, and that gets down to what can you expect on privacy as a consumer? What can you expect on security as a consumer? What can you expect in terms of treatment in marketplaces if you're a small business or even a pretty big business, but just not a $1 trillion business? Those are important questions. And then there's the issue of either punishing success or when does a technology business get so big that it's a monopoly versus maybe there are rules of the road that you need to establish, and you're trying to establish those by breaking up companies. That doesn't make sense. And I think as I do the reporting and look through this stuff, some of the rules of the road stuff is not just about big companies. Ransomware issues, security issues are plaguing smaller companies too, Carl, and sometimes they're even more susceptible to them, and consumer data ends up being lost. So maybe there needs to be a reframing and refocus on what the issues really are that are affecting consumers on the one side, smaller businesses on the other, around competition and expectations in a digital economy.
Yeah. John, and one other headline that kind of got lost in the course of the week was this Reuters headline that the U.S. and the EU are looking to work more closely in regulating big tech at the upcoming summit. Areas of cooperation could include antitrust, content moderation, semis, climate. So it's not just solely a U.S. reg story.
Yeah, some of those things, particularly when it comes to climate and semiconductors, Julia, some of the bigger tech companies are actually making bigger strides on because they have a lot of resources.
Yes, but also if you look, John, at the way the EU has taken bolder steps to crack down on privacy issues than the U.S. has, I think that we should really look at the EU as a potential leader. Whatever they do, it's likely that the U.S. could follow, or at least these tech companies could be forced to take similar moves across the world because they need to have some consistency in terms of how they operate.
Yeah, true indeed. Well, let's also get a gut check on Salesforce. Shares rallied 7% yesterday, the company raising its revenue forecast and put out a better than expected outlook for fiscal 23. Piper Sandler likes what they heard too this morning, upgrading the stock to overweight from neutral. Price target goes to 365 from 280. They say Salesforce could become a must own asset for growth investors, given it trades at a lower enterprise value to sales ratio than Microsoft and Adobe. Carl, I thought it already was a must-own for growth. I mean, if you like stocks that go up, and if you like exciting CEOs and founders, it would have been a mistake to ignore Mark Benioff.
Yes, indeed. We got a number of really positive notes today on CRM. Piper, of course, goes to 350 or 360, something like that. Morgan Stanley, Julia, Analyst Day was a game changer as management finally convinced people that the margin expansion story is real.
Yeah, I mean, some really compelling stories there from Salesforce about what's ahead. I think this idea that Slack is going to be really essential to Salesforce's growth. The integration has been going well. And then also, I want to note something as the media reporter here, that Salesforce launched a TV service, a streaming video service, Salesforce Plus. Now, while this may sound like a niche product, I think what's really interesting here about this streaming service they're going to be offering, sort of LinkedIn-style business content, is that Salesforce really sees itself as a resource for businesses. They want to be a one-stop shop. They want to be educating everyone who works at the company. And this is potentially a very valuable marketing tool for them. But I think the launch of all of this business content that's going to be available for free really speaks to how they're seeing themselves and as playing a greater role in all sorts of different businesses going forward.
Now you said might seem like a
John,
niche.
Do you agree?
You said might seem like a niche. You think Ted Sarandos is worried?
No, not at all. I think this is more like a LinkedIn product than like a Netflix product. But I think what they're doing here is, you know, they're not selling streaming video content, John. They're offering it as a marketing tool to show just how powerful Salesforce can be. And I think this represents sort of Benioff's vision for being an essential tool for all businesses, John, right?
Well, I don't know. LinkedIn-like, maybe. Is Satya Nadella, is Ryan Roslansky worried? I'll try to find out. Salesforce has a lot of reach, that's for sure.
Has a lot of reach indeed. John, the question is at what point you start making content for Salesforce Plus instead of LinkedIn. Now, meanwhile, after the break, completely running blind, Facebook struggled with Apple's new privacy rules. The stock's down 9% in September. Tech is just getting started.
Robinhood had some trouble telling a consistent story in January after it paused trading with a spike in volatility around meme stocks. And now a lawsuit alleges the company wasn't being honest with its users when explaining why. Kate Rooney has details. Kate?
Hey, John. This lawsuit gives a new look inside the room, or at least the chat rooms over at Robinhood, during the GameStop short squeeze. These internal conversations from back in January show debates over how bad it could get, some panic over capital requirements, and a direct contradiction of what Robinhood CEO told CNBC's Andrew Ross Sorkin at the time. On January 28th, the company's COO messaged internally that Robinhood, quote, had a major liquidity issue. CEO Vlad Tenev, meanwhile, denied that in an interview with Andrew. That week, though, Robinhood did move to change stocks like GameStop and AMC to what they call position close only, meaning that people could sell, but they couldn't buy. In response to that decision, another executive says, we're going to get crucified for those restrictions. It's a, quote, horrible look, they say, for the wider brokerage industry. And meanwhile, the COO of Robinhood Financial, that's a subsidiary of Robinhood, saying that the company was, quote, too big for them to actually shut us down. He's referring there to its clearing agency. And in another conversation with CEO Vlad Tenev, they talk about implementing something called Code Yellow. An engineer says that maybe we should consider an all-hands-on-deck situation. Tenev seems to agree and says, quote, only the paranoid survive. All of this, guys, came out as part of discovery in a class-action lawsuit. The plaintiff's lawyer argues that Robinhood didn't do enough to protect investors and, quote, kept its doors open, unbeknownst to the general public, while it was teetering on the verge of collapse. And in response, Robinhood says, we dispute the plaintiff's allegations. The communications are consistent with Robinhood's focus to take appropriate incremental measures to mitigate risk. Guys, back to you.
To me, this sounds like a code red, Kate. I guess my question is, obviously, the company has changed quite a bit since they had this moment of crisis about 9 months ago. But do these interactions, do those messages reveal persistent problems that could still be at the company today?
So that's what the lawyers argue. Well, it is sort of a look at this one-time event. They called it a Four Sigma event at the time. And the company has argued that there's nothing that they could have done. This was unforeseen and that all of the measures they had in place were appropriate and the problem was solved. The lawyers, meanwhile, say that some of the conversations show that the executives here knew this was coming. They called it a tidal wave of volatility and said that there wasn't enough attention paid. And they, meanwhile, were focused more on things like the Super Bowl ad, marketing, and adding new users. So a difference of opinion there. But it's interesting. We had Bob Pisani reporting this week on Gary Gensler coming out with a report on this entire saga. People have been waiting for that for months. And I'm told that the SEC and FINRA also have access to these documents. So it'll be interesting to see if there's anything in there that actually comes out in a follow-up report from Gary Gensler.
Fantastic. Fantastic reporting, Kate. Thanks so much. Meantime, our next guest says Apple's attempts to kneecap Facebook advertising with its anti-tracking initiative is working. Let's bring in CNBC contributor and founder of Substack newsletter, Big Technology, Alex Kantrowitz. Alex, great read here. But the issue I see is that it's not that Facebook's ads aren't working. It's that Facebook can't track how well its ads are working. Do you think Facebook is going to be able to fix this measurement issue?
Well, I would say that they're one and the same, right? Because what happens is an advertiser runs an ad on Facebook. Then they see whether somebody purchased, and they can determine whether they're effective that way and optimize based off of that. So when they can't measure, they can't optimize effectively, the ads work less good. And so Facebook is going to move from what it calls a deterministic model to a more probabilistic model. What that means in layman's speak is basically saying we're going to move from what we know to what we think based off of some sophisticated models. Can that work? Maybe, but it's certainly not going to work as well as it worked in the past when Facebook knew for sure when the ads were working and when they weren't. And this is a major challenge for the company.
Yeah, Alex, you say in your newsletter that you believe that this Apple iOS change could have irreparable impact on Facebook. But the way I see it, Facebook has two things working in its favor. Massive reach, number one, and two, the fact that it has some time to try to figure out a solution to this. Do you think that advertisers are really going to flee and not come back?
Okay, so here's why I think it could cause irreparable damage. The reason is that this is a wake-up call for a lot of particularly performance advertisers, the people who want you to buy right after you click, because they've been so reliant on Facebook because Facebook performs so well. And so they haven't really diversified their channels. What this is showing them now, it's working a little bit less good. And what this is showing them is like, maybe we need to be in Snapchat. Maybe we need to be in TikTok. Maybe we even need to be in email. That's what I've heard today or this week. And so, you know, is this going to destroy Facebook's advertising business? Hardly. I think they're a $30 billion a quarter business. That's bringing in a ton of ad revenue, but it can hamper them and it can send advertisers elsewhere. On the bright side, I think it might actually improve advertising. What I heard in my conversations with advertisers this week is, you know, instead of optimizing based off of data, they're optimizing based off of creative. So, you know, they're putting a bunch of different ads in and the system is optimizing and seeing, you know, what's the ad that actually resonates with people the most versus, you know, based off of the way it looks instead of based off of who they are. And I think that's a really positive sign for the advertising industry if that's what happens.
Yeah, Alex, as a consumer, you know, break out the world's smallest violin, right? Like, this is about me getting to choose what happens with my data and whether I'm being tracked all over the place. You know, Apple's asking me when I open up, you know, iOS 15 about email, about various things. I like that. So if it forces people to be more creative about the effectiveness of their advertising, I don't care.
No doubt. Well, I think there's two countervailing factors here, right? The first one is what Facebook always says, and I think there's some truth to it, that you're going to want relevant ads. And you get relevant ads when the advertisers know who you are. The other side of it is, you know, back in the day when advertising was in its heyday, we ended up enjoying ads versus right now, most people hate them because they're ugly. We enjoyed them because they were beautiful. Because instead of spending all the time figuring out what data gets you the most optimized ad, you'd spend your time, if you were an ad agency, on what image is going to resonate most with the public. So we might end up getting stuff that's a little bit less relevant to us, but, you know, is nicer to look at. And I agree with you. I think that could be a pretty good thing for us consumers at the end of the day.
Yeah, Alex, maybe I'm weird. I don't want relevant ads. you know, when the ads get really relevant, I get concerned, right? Maybe give me ads based on what I'm looking at, not based on who I am and like all the things that you think I've ever looked at as you were following me around. That's creepy to me. And, you know, the idea of them being able to pivot and look for other signals that are less personal, maybe not as derived from location and other kind of personalized data. That sounds good to me, and what a lot of industry groups and governments perhaps are pushing for.
No doubt. Yeah, I'm not going to sit here and defend the state of internet advertising. I think everybody knows it's terrible. And if we do get back to a place where advertisers use less data, they can still run effective ads, then Facebook can do interesting things on the back end, like creative optimization, where you put like 100 different types of ads and it will end up showing the one that resonates the most with people. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the relevant ads thing, there is something to it. But by and large, I agree with your position wholeheartedly, which is that let's get back to an advertising industry that didn't rely on the creepy siphoning of data and more toward an advertising industry that shows us ads we like to look at. I mean, that's how brands should win over our affinity, not by mining, you know, our behavior and matching their ads to what we're doing, but by telling us a compelling message and one that gets us to buy for the right reasons.
Well, Alex, I like ads that are relevant and are things I'd like to buy. Fascinating space to watch. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, why iPhone wait times are going to be longer this year and what that might mean for shares of Apple. Plus, a day after Guggenheim upgraded Roku, Wells goes the other way. They say ARPU projections are likely too high as the competition increases. The stock is giving back about 4% today. We are back after this. Welcome back to Tech Check, resetting here near the bottom of the hour. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Julia Borston and John Fort. NASDAQ so far underperforming the Dow and the S&P for the month, although we are still just 2.5% from all-time highs. We'll get a lot more on what has been a busy week for the markets in just a moment. But first, a news update with Rahel Solomon. Hi, Rahel.
Hi, Carl. Good morning. And here's what's happening at this hour. New home sales rising for a second straight month in August. The Commerce Department reporting a 1.5% increase. Even as rising prices continue to sideline potential buyers, the median price of a new home ticked up in August to nearly $391,000. That's a jump of more than 20% over the last year. Treasury bond yields continue to surge following the Fed's decision to soon begin tapering asset purchases. The 10-year note has broken above 1.45%, its highest level since early July. Shares of Nike extending losses following disappointing quarterly sales and lowered guidance due to supply shortages. Nike down nearly 7% today. Stock also on track for its biggest daily loss in 15 months. And the Washington Capitals have signed a key sponsorship deal with Caesars Sportsbook. The agreement makes the Capitals the first major American sports team to put the logo of a gambling company on its game jerseys. And John, I think earlier this week, the Sixers also did something with a crypto company on their jerseys. So it's been an interesting week in sports and investing.
It has indeed. Uniforms. Yeah. Rahel, thanks. Now, the new iPhone hits stores today. Deliveries begin if you ordered early enough. Wait time for a new phone is stretching now into October, but we've all been wondering, investors certainly, are these wait times a sign of high demand, low supply, combination of both? What's going to be most popular? Is it those at the high end that has a big impact on margins? Joining us now with some data is Cowen's Krish Sankar. Krish, you think that based on the supply chain checks that you've got, that they've actually built significantly more than last year. That would be good news for investors if that pans out, right?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me, John. And yes, I would say that the builds have been pretty strong. But keep in mind, last year, the phone was released a month later. And obviously, along with the COVID supply chain challenges, even though the phone was released in October, by the time in China, people got a hands on it, was already November. So you definitely had a month or so of loss last year that you don't have this year. So clearly, numbers are looking pretty good. And for what it's worth, just an hour and a half ago, I got my new iPhone 13 Pro Max. So it's still downloading from the iCloud.
Do you have a sense of how much of the build is toward the high end versus the lower end of the range? I mean, it seems like that there are longer wait times for the high-end phones, which is good if they built a lot of high-end phones, but maybe if they're having trouble with components on the high end or they didn't build as many, it means something different.
Yeah, I think it's too early to, you know, figure that out, but I would say it definitely does skew more towards, historically has been more on the Pro side versus the regular. So I think that seems to be the trend so far. And so I would say, you know, kind of that's where it is. But keep in mind, the overall securing of components for the iPhone in general has been better than, you know, Apple's other products like the iPad and the MacBook, et cetera. So it definitely seems like, you know, in general, the component tightness is actually the better situation for the iPhone. And within that, I would probably say it does skew more towards the iPhone Pro at this point, but I think it's still too early to make the call.
And Krish, I know it is early, but at this early stage, where do you think the basket of opportunity is deeper, in Apple itself or in the component makers?
That's actually a really good question. I mean, I guess it really depends on how you're going to look at it, right? Obviously, if you're like a large cap, mega cap, I would probably say, you know, I still like Apple is a good way to play it. The one thing I would keep in mind is, I think to your point, Carl, historically, if you look at the trend of Apple, typically the stock does run into the iPhone release. So like the few months before that is a strong period. And right after the iPhone release, typically in calendar Q4, is a seasonally slow period for the stock. Even though it's seasonally the strongest quarter for the company, it is actually the opposite for the stock. So I think from the point, if you're trying to do like a short-term positioning, you're probably better off on the supply chain. But I think longer term, I think Apple is still a great story. But keep in mind, the just the seasonality in terms of positioning always does skew away from Apple post the phone release.
Krish, just to follow on Carl's question, though, looking at the broader ecosystem, what is your outlook now on some of those component makers? And how are those stocks going to be impacted from some of the trends you're seeing in the data?
Sure. So as of now, I would say if you look at the overall smartphone supply chain, you know, where you're seeing the one place where the strength has been very strong and consistent is the iPhone, right? We did see like some movement in OVX, the Oppo, Vivo, Xiaomi, Samsung, and then you just begin to see some of like Huawei tail off and Honor start picking up some of the slack in China. So you've seen some movement on the OVX Samsung side. Apple has been pretty consistent. So with that respect, I'd say anyone levered to the Apple supply chain is still probably going to do well. But keep in mind, seasonality does play into effect. Calendar Q1 is seasonally slow for Apple and also the supply chain. But in general, I would say anyone levered to the Apple supply chain should do well, especially given the fact that the numbers have been consistently strong, not just globally, but also in China and the U.S.
Krish, if I recall, last year with Apple stores closed, there was some negative impact that Apple saw to accessories like Apple Watch that people like to browse in person. I wonder if you have any insight on either attach rates or the degree to which that might be different now with, you know, not that the pandemic has passed, but there have been adjustments. Stores are open.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, John, you're totally right. I think any of those accessories are always had better sell-through when the stores are open because it feels like people want to touch and feel it and like wear it before actually buying it. Now that the stores are slowly beginning to open compared to a year ago, the trends are improving. The only caveat I would say is that kind of, I think what is the push and pull or the tug of war right now is the stores are opening up, which is a positive, and generally we see improving momentum in the wearable segment. The only way you get a handicap is also there is still component tightness, especially on the wearable side. And a great example is that's one of the reasons why the Apple Watch is not, the CD7 is not available today. It's probably later October or early November while the iPhone is available.
Ah, well, I guess you can't attach it if you can't buy it yet. Krish Sankar from Cowen, thank you.
Thank you.
After the break, we're live at the courthouse as witnesses begin testifying against Elizabeth Holmes. Don't go away.
The trial against Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes rolls on. Yesterday, retired General James Mattis took the stand, as you may know, the first of many high-profile witnesses. Scott Cohn's outside the courtroom in San Jose with more, Scott. And everything we've learned this week regarding the Mattis testimony was truly gripping.
Yeah, and there's been so much of this. This is officially day 10 of the jury trial. Elizabeth Holmes arriving a short time ago, as is typically the case, arriving hand in hand with her mother. And so we're kind of in the early going here. Remember, what the government has to prove here is not only that Elizabeth Holmes was in control at Theranos, but also that she knew that the statements that she was making to investors, doctors, and patients were false. And so we've seen a series of Theranos insiders talking about just that. We expect this morning to hear from a former Theranos lab director. But also this week, we got the first of what we expect will be a number of bold-faced names. As Carl said, James Mattis, the former U.S. Defense Secretary, Before he was defense secretary, he was a Theranos board member and investor. And, of course, before that, he was a four-star general. And in court, before a very attentive jury, he talked about how he first came to meet Elizabeth Holmes back in 2011 when he was still in the military and was instantly taken with the prospects for the technology for blood testing, both on the battlefield and to lower health care costs in general. But ultimately, he testified, as the negative reports about the company came out in 2015, that he didn't really know what to believe. We're hearing a lot more about also the relationship between Elizabeth Holmes and the former chief operating officer, Sonny Balwani, both in court and also in this cache of texts that our CNBC producer Yasmin Khorum uncovered earlier this week. There's really thousands of these text messages over a period of years, with the two of them really kind of collaborating about the company and where it was going, but also not beyond a little bit of dishing, like the day in 2015 when Sonny Balwani saw Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg at a Starbucks, and he texts to Holmes that she was wearing sweatpants and looked weak, I think. Maybe that's how she looks without makeup. Holmes replies, yeah, she always dresses up. Weak, like as a leader, weak. Remember that Holmes, part of her defense may be that she claims that Balwani abused her for many years, and because of that, she couldn't form the intent to commit a crime. Balwani, of course, has denied that. We will see how that goes and how some of these texts play into it as this trial rolls on, likely to go into December. Guys?
Wow, thanks so much, Scott. And check out shares of Barry Diller's IAC, reportedly in talks to buy magazine publisher Meredith, which is valued at more than $2.5 billion. Meredith recently sold off high-profile brands such as Sports Illustrated and Time Magazine, but it still owns People Magazine. We'll continue to watch that story. Tech Check is back in a moment. CNBC is celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month, and all month long here on Tech Check, we're highlighting diverse executives in tech. Software company Drift is one of the few Latino-founded and led startups that has reached unicorn status. Since 2015, over $15 billion has been raised by Black and Latinx founders, representing 2.4% of the total venture capital raised in that time. Joining us now is Drift CEO David Cancel. David, before we get to your business, I just want to get your perspective here as a real outlier in this world. Can you give us some perspective on what fundraising was like for you and what you think the real hurdles are that need to be addressed in this industry?
Sure. I think looking backwards, I can see where kind of those hurdles were. At the time, I kind of had to put my blinders on and kind of get through it and try to succeed no matter what. But looking backwards, I could see, you know, it was hard for me to naturally break in, to make connections, and we just had to find different ways. And, you know, I always say it took me a decade of my career before I met someone else that looked like me in the tech industry, which is bizarre to think about now. And but now, you know, we're starting.
David, I wonder whether or not you think that given that experience, you should be more attentive to hiring from the Latin community than some of your peers, or should it not matter? Should there be more just sort of agnosticism regarding your recruiting process?
I think that's a great question. I think, you know, we take it to heart, myself and my co-founder, who's also Latinx, and we think we have a responsibility not only to focus on from a hiring standpoint, but also to focus from trying to become role models for those people who are in grade school, middle school, who haven't made a decision to go into STEM like we have, to know that they can do it as well.
David, talk to us about what Drift is doing with conversational marketing and sales, and how either reliance on your software offerings or maybe the demands for new types of features and services during the pandemic has played out for you.
Sure. What we didn't know is that we all fast forwarded by a decade in terms of having enterprise companies adopt a digital approach and really to understand that they could actually sell digitally without getting on planes, without steak dinners, without meeting people in person, that they could sell the biggest of contracts and the biggest of deals, and we could do that. And so that happened over this period. And so what we do is we help connect buyers and try to make it simple for businesses to buy from other businesses by doing the thing that we've always done for all of time, which is to have a conversation and to actually build a relationship and make that connection. We just happen to use technology to accelerate that.
Now, David, earlier this month, you announced a big investment partnership with Vista. Tell us what that deal is going to do and where you're focused on growing now.
Yes. So that is a big thing for us. You know, we made this incredible partnership with Vista and with Vista, and it's helping us break into and understand what we need to do in order to build a public company. And so that's a big one for us.
Well, David, we look forward to watching you continue on that journey. Thanks for joining us today.
Take a look at some cloud computing indexes here. A little bit to the red side as we do get some decent news out of components like Salesforce on the heels of that investor day. Major indices in the meantime have been alternating between gains and losses. S&P 4445 is still about 12 points above the break even for the week, John.
Yep. And let's get a quick programming note. Tech Check's going to be live from the Code Conference next week in L.A., a series of big interviews with tech executives and investors. I'll be alongside Kara Swisher in conversation with AMD's Lisa Su. Also taking the stage there, Elon Musk, Satya Nadella, and Netflix's Ted Sarandos. And speaking of which, we're going to have much more on Netflix's content push on the other side of this break. Tech Check, be right back.
Tomorrow, Netflix is hosting its first ever global fan event, calling it Ta-dum after this sound. That is the sound you hear anytime you stream anything on Netflix. Now, in this streaming event, tomorrow is expected to last 3 hours. Stars and creators from 70 different series and films will connect with their fans and share some clips to build awareness about Netflix's brands. Now, this is just the latest move from the streamer to bring its brands off the platform. Earlier this week, it launched its first game, Eden, on Oculus, and it's building its library of brands, buying Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and the rest of the Roald Dahl catalog, also announced just this week. Now, Stifel raising its price target on Netflix, citing all the content that Netflix has coming, saying that it will spend $17 billion on content this year, predicting all that content will drive subscriber growth. So, Carl, taking brands, moving them off of the platform, to me, that sounds a lot like a Disney-type move.
Yes, we're going to talk a bit more about Netflix here with us to talk about it. Evercore ISI head of Internet Research, Mark Mahaney. Mark, as Julia points out, what a week of news flow, whether it's the Kenya news or the gaming or Roald Dahl or even this growing consensus that they are on a path towards self-funding content. Is that where you are?
Yeah, you didn't mention that Tiger King 2 is coming out in the fourth quarter. That's a big event for a name like this. And then what we're going to find out this weekend, hopefully, is the timing on some of these new launches that are coming out. When about Crown, Ozark, Stranger Things? When are we going to get these? When we get those dates, I think people will have confidence that the content slate is improving and the subscriber growth can continue to recover.
We've talked in the past, I mean in years past, about the seasonality of subs that I think Q4 is historically strong. Has that changed?
No, it hasn't changed at all. And so can the company guide towards 7 to 8 million subscribers for the December quarter when they print the September quarter? If they do, the stock goes materially higher. If they guide materially below that, the stock's going back to 500.
And Mark, you know, there's always such a focus on subscriber numbers, but also on the content that drives the subscriber numbers. But looking at the game move in particular, the acquisition of Roald Dahl, do you think there's any shift in strategy? I have to note that Reed Hastings mentioned very much in passing that those F1 rights, if they came up again, he would be interested in looking at them. Is he making any changes here?
I think they're expanding their content library. I think that's how we view gaming. Whether gaming really works on Netflix or not, I think is an unknown. I don't think the company knows. I think it's a risky bet, but it's one that they need to make. And then F1 to me is an example of Netflix impacting the zeitgeist, just like they did with chess sales last year and Queen's Gambit. Look what they've done with F1. They've actually made Formula One popular amongst American viewers. What a success for Netflix.
Mark, it seems like some of Netflix's moves are towards smoothing out kind of these hit-driven spikes and maybe some of the churn that they see in between shows. But they're a long way from Disney, right, which has these buckets that are very clear. Marvel, Lucasfilm, Princesses, High School Musical. It's like you know what the content is, the brand is strong, you know who it's for. Does Netflix need to build out these portfolios of types of content more clearly demarcated to achieve what it's trying to here?
I completely agree with the point behind your question, John. If Netflix wants to go from 200 million subscribers today to half a billion in 10 years, they have to have tentpole content productions. And so, yeah, they need to have that kind of Marvel library. And hopefully they're building that now with things like Stranger Things.
Mark, I loved your note earlier in the week, I think, where you hosted Professor DeMoterin from Stern. And his view on Netflix was that they need to find a better balance between sort of this buckshot, just a slew of content, and the more rifle-like strategy of HBO. Do you agree with him?
Not on valuation. I think he got it wrong. But I think he's right in terms of the way they should approach content and way they should disclose their content spend plans. The way to think about Netflix is they've got 17 billion shots on goal, and we think that they'll be able to get some of these will come through. So I don't think it's as rifle shot as he implicated.
But Mark, as we look at these show and content announcements tomorrow, I'm wondering if you could put it in the context of the competitive landscape, because now Netflix isn't the only one putting big, expensive movies out right away. Now they're also up against HBO Max and all of these other players that are shortening windows or getting rid of that theatrical window altogether. Is that going to prove a challenge for Netflix next year?
I think so. The only hedge that Netflix has is that what's really replacing linear TV isn't Netflix or Disney Plus or HBO Max, it's the streaming bundle. And our survey work increasingly shows consumers want to buy not just one, but two and three plus subscription services. And the advantage for Netflix is they're almost certainly going to be one of those.
Mark, what a week. Just such a busy time on your beat. Always good to check in with you. Thanks. Mark Mahaney
Thanks,
joining
Carl.
Us talking some Netflix today. Markets treading the flat line, at least so far this morning. S&P is a touch green, but literally by 0.01% as we try to hold some break-even levels. Next week's going to be busy. We're going to have Micron. We're going to have some key votes, maybe, in Congress. And, John, of course, Code, where we'll hope to hear from Elon Musk, Sarandos, and Lisa Su with you.
Yeah, looking forward to talking to Lisa Su. We were just talking with Chris Shankar about supply versus demand questions with the iPhone and, of course, with the PS5 and the Xbox, Julia. AMD is very much a player in that.
You've been listening to CNBC's Tech Check. You can always catch us live weekdays at 11 a.m.